Welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I will be talking with J. Mark Souther, author of the book, Believing in Cleveland, Managing Decline in the Best Location in the Nation. The book was published in 2017 by Temple University Press. Mark is a professor of history at Cleveland State University and has written a great study of how the city dealt with decline and renewal. He shows that the process wasn't linear, but was heavily affected by the city leaders, both public and private. Welcome, Mark Souther. Hi, Mark. Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you for having me.
I know it's a busy time for you between the release of the book and the publicity you have scheduled for it. Plus, you're right in the middle of the semester at Cleveland State University, so I'm glad we were able to find time.
Yeah, I'm glad too. Thank you.
So I wanted to mention a couple things up front. You and I actually know each other. You were my professor for my final research project at Cleveland State when I earned my master's degree in history there. I wrote a paper related to civil defense in the 1950s in Cleveland. And the second thing I wanted to mention up front is that I lived in Cleveland for almost my entire life, so I was there for most of the time period the book covers. So that's another sort of unusual thing as far as I'm concerned as it relates to this book. So I just figured I'd mention that up front so that the audience had some sense of where I'm coming from with this particular book and why I really wanted to do this interview. But let's start through with some of your background. You've lived in Cleveland for quite a while, but you're actually a child of the South. Can you talk a little bit about your education and previous writing?
Sure. I'm originally from Gainesville, Georgia, which is in northeast Georgia between Atlanta and the Appalachian Mountains. And I went to college at Furman University in South Carolina in the early 90s, got my BA in history, and studied with some fantastic professors, among them, I hate to single out just one person, but my advisor, I'll give a hat tip to Lloyd Benson, really inspired me to become a history major. So I'll never forget that. And I decided about midway through Furman that I wanted to go on and do more. I couldn't get enough of history, and I thought I might want to go into academia. So I went to the University of Richmond in Virginia and got my MA in 1996. And from there, I went on to Tulane University in New Orleans. And it was there that I got into tourism. I'd actually done a little bit, I suppose I should say, with tourism back at U of R. Did a master's thesis on the early development of Virginia Beach as a seaside resort. But I was not really doing that with urban history in mind. And so the difference in my work was that when I got to Tulane, I got interested in tourism and how it had so radically reshaped New Orleans as a city. So that was my first foray into doing, urban tourism, really, as opposed to resort development. So that's what got me started with the project that led to my first book, New Orleans on Parade, which LSU Press published in 2006.
I know you also, in fact, I didn't even, when I was on your website, I spotted it, the book you were an editor of. In fact, it looked so interesting. I said, I got to see if I can find that book someplace, because it sounded, you were an editor of a collection of, a co-editor of books dealing with tourism. What was that book?
That's called American Tourism. Constructing a National Identity. Oh, let's back up. You can edit this out.
That's fine.
That book is called, let me back up again.
All
sorry.
Right.
That book is called American Tourism, Constructing a National Tradition. And it's a collection of 35 essays by scholars and public historians and others who have connections to, in some cases, places of tourist interest. And so the 35 essays are about iconic places around the United States. So, Wall Drug, Faneuil Hall Marketplace in Boston, Olvera Street in downtown Los Angeles, just to name a few, Pike Place Market in Seattle, and so on. So I co-edited that book for the Center for American Places in 2012. And, you know, I had high hopes for the book, but it came right at the tail end of the existence of the Center for American Places. And so in some ways, I think it's unfortunate that we did not get that book out sooner when that press was still really very much alive. So it was on the very tail end of its existence. So the book came out, and then it really didn't seem to draw a wide readership or even to find its way into reviewers' hands. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of sorry about that, because we certainly worked very hard on the book, and I think that the contributors did a wonderful job of really speaking in a sort of a public-facing way with their writing. So many of them were academics, but they crafted these essays in such a way that I think they have wide appeal. I'm really proud of that book, and I know my co-editor really also is. So I wish that maybe that book had seen the light of day a little bit more.
Yeah, as somebody who obviously reads a lot of history, I'm always looking for good history collections of essays. I think obviously there's plenty of monographs out there, but I think sometimes nothing's better than sitting down with a book of essays all related to a single topic, because I think you learn so much about the topics, but then you also get such a different view of how somebody reviews a topic, and they can be so interesting. So I always am looking for a new collection, so to speak, even though that one's not that new anymore. So I'm sorry that it didn't do as well either, but anyway, it's still out there, which is a good thing. So that's a positive. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about some concepts, and you've used a couple of the terms already, and so I wanted to talk a little bit about the terms public history and how it relates to urban history, and I know these terms are important both for your career and this book. And wasn't there a recent conference that just ended up in Cleveland related to these topics?
Yes, the Society for American City and Regional Planning History, or SACRIP, as members call it. For short, SACRPH is the rather awkward acronym, but it's a wonderful organization I've been involved in for about 16 years now. First conference that I attended was in Philadelphia in 2001, and it really introduced me much more to the field of urban history and urban planning history. So I really got to meet a lot of wonderful people who were wonderful mentors to me over the ensuing 16 years. And so I really wanted to bring this conference to Cleveland. The organization was born in 1986 in Columbus and Cincinnati. I think the first conference was in Columbus, but it had a lot of involvement from people down in Cincinnati as well. But it, in all the years of its existence, 30 years or so, it had never been to Cleveland. And so here I am up here in Cleveland thinking, how are we going to get this conference into town? And I really didn't have time to focus on this for a long time. And I finally decided in 2015, this is something I'd really like to pursue. So I did. I expressed an interest and put in a proposal, and lo and behold, we were able to bring it to Cleveland. And I worked with really a lot of wonderful people, and also from my own college, from the College of the Maxine Goodman Levin College for Urban Affairs at CSU, and Kent State University. And it was really a pleasure to welcome more than 300 people to Cleveland.
Okay, so let's go back to the terms now. The public history and urban history. What, to someone who may have a general knowledge of history but may not necessarily understand what those specific disciplines are, could you go a little bit of background on those?
Sure. Well, I can start with public history. Public history is what's a term that's evolved over time, like a lot of fields have evolved. It really is pretty wide ranging. Some people would define it as history as it's practiced in public places and with publics, plural, meaning that there's no one public. The public has great diversity. And so how do we present history, and how do we do history for and often with the public? So I think over the years, there's been an increasing interest in sharing authority, to borrow a term from Michael Frisch at the University at Buffalo. He coined the term, as far as I know, shared authority. It was the title of a book that he wrote a number of years ago about oral history. And it really, I think, it's captured so well what public historians aspire to do, which is to share authority, to recognize that people in the community from all walks of life possess knowledge about the past. And if we engage with them, if we listen as well as talk, we are able to craft a story about the past in such a rich way. So it takes all kinds of forms too, anything from museum exhibitions to heritage sites, National Park Service units and how they interpret history. There's oral history, digital history, including mobile apps, which I've had, and really just a range of other things that you could rattle off. Turning to urban history is a field that, of course, grows out of an interest in understanding how cities grow and develop and how they connect, how their histories connect to that of the broader society. And it's also wide ranging. So you have people who specialize in various forms of urban history. Some people are really into, planning history. And part of what I do is the history of planning. But it's not just about urban planners. It's also about the people who are affected by the plans, the people who shape the plans, sometimes the people who protest the plans. There are certainly social and cultural and political and economic dimensions of this. So some people are looking at all of those. And still others really look at the environmental aspects of it. So how is a city constructed in terms of infrastructure? And what do the decisions that are made about how cities are laid out and how they're, literally constructed physically, how do those shape the lives of the people who live in cities, often very unevenly? So you get into issues of, sort of structural issues of environmental racism in cities that you can see, and especially in cases such as when you have a natural disaster, partly a man-made disaster like Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans more than a decade ago. Places such as the Lower Ninth Ward suffered disproportionately, and that connects to a broad history of African Americans often being trapped in, floodplains, low-lying areas of cities that were maybe not the choicest land, but it was what they maybe had access to.
It's interesting because one of the things over time from my studies there is that I was reading some of the information that's out there that went on when the federal highways were being built and some of the fighting that went on the east side suburbs to keep a freeway from coming through that area, Shaker Heights, Cleveland Heights area. So when you talk about protests, that's, I think, a prime example of where a protest actually worked.
It's true, although, it's interesting. I tell people the Clark Freeway, which is part of the broader Shaker Lakes Freeway fight that you're speaking of on the east side of Cleveland, that required a lot of clout. The people who lived in Shaker Heights were people who had really a way of bending the ear of influential and powerful people. And what happens in other places, I think about, for example, how I've also written about New Orleans and how the Riverfront Expressway was going to go, right between the French Quarter and the Mississippi River. And people with a tremendous degree of clout were able to stop that before it, succeeded in doing what many people would say would be destroying, New Orleans' really prime location and one of the most historic places in the United States. But then you go less than a mile away back from the river and you find that a similar elevated expressway that carries to this day, it carries Interstate Highway 10, goes right through Treme. And so who had a voice in the African-American community that wrecked pretty much. Mm-hmm. It went right atop, you know, it goes right over the North Claiborne Avenue, which was a beautiful oak-lined thoroughfare that had a lot of really sort of one of the hearts of the African-American business community. And it was laid waste by this freeway plan. And so it really hammers home that, you know, when you're talking about who can shape the direction of cities, it's easier said than done if you don't have the right connections. And so the suburbanites are better positioned sometimes than people in the central city, or people who are connected to a part of the city that's been privileged over others, such as the French Quarter, maybe have a greater chance of succeeding.
Right. So let's start to get towards the book, the book itself. What made Cleveland so useful as a subject? I know you lived there and you had access to many sources, but you had a number of good reasons for choosing the city as a place to, as an area to study. What were some of the reasons you thought Cleveland was a useful subject?
First of all, I was dissatisfied really with the fact that there was not enough written by historians about modern Cleveland after World War II. I didn't really see a great deal of scholarship from historians. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't a lot of excellent work. You know, in the area of urban studies, there's been more done on Cleveland, and but historians did not really do a whole lot with modern Cleveland. So that was the first point. But what I think really drove me to this topic was that, you know, having done a study of New Orleans and how tourism transformed that city after World War II, I realize that has very much to do with selling a city to outsiders. So what does it mean to sell a very different kind of city, like Cleveland, a city that is not really a tourist destination, at least not in the way that New Orleans is? It's having some success now as a destination. But I was more interested once I started to see that Clevelanders had this it's been commented on by many people over the years, I came to find out, an inferiority complex. This idea that Cleveland had fallen short, it was a once great city that had fallen on hard times, and that maybe it had not really seen the type of rebound that some other cities had seen. And so I really wanted to look into why that mentality was here. And what did it mean? What does it mean to sell a city to its own people? And in some ways, I think really that's what the image campaigns that I grabbed hold of to as subjects of study really did, was that they were as much, at least as much, about selling Cleveland to Clevelanders, getting Clevelanders to modulate their opinion of how the city was doing, as they were directed toward, for example, corporate decision makers in New York City who might be looking for a place to relocate corporate headquarters. So those are a couple of the reasons that I really thought that a book like what I was proposing really made sense.
Yeah, I know this book is actually something you've been working on for quite a while. So obviously things that have happened, you know, I can think of a couple of things that take place after this book, as far as, because your book only goes obviously so far. But I mean, simple things like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and to this day that there are still people who felt it shouldn't have been in Cleveland, and Clevelanders still have that chip on their shoulder about the fact that the annual event is not in Cleveland, it's in New York most of the time. So they've had it in Cleveland a few times, but it's another example. But the image problem, and I'll talk about it as somebody who lived in Cleveland for so long. It's been, you know, Cleveland's the butt of jokes all the time. The Cleveland jokes are normal. People who live outside, the people who live there really seem to care what the outside world thinks of them. Even to this day, people will complain about sports broadcasters and say, oh, they're against Cleveland. They're obviously care about they like the other team better than Cleveland. And that image issue is you said it, but I want to bring this back. Is this unusual, or do other cities have some of traits like this in your view?
I think other cities do have this trait. There's a certain myopia that goes along with living in any one city and focusing too closely on one place. You can get very caught up in thinking that, our problems are so much worse. You know, Cleveland has our own sort of civic cloud hanging over us, and the sun never shines here. And you can look across at Pittsburgh or you know, some other city in the region perhaps, and see some project or some story about a positive outcome or development, and think, oh, why can't we do what they're doing over there? And I saw a lot of evidence of that in all that I looked at. In fact, Pittsburgh was, of all the cities that Clevelanders looked to, Pittsburgh was the one, I think, with which Clevelanders felt the keenest competition. It was closest to us. It experienced a similar economic decline in heavy industry. It had similar urban problems to Cleveland and to a lot of cities in what sometimes became known later as the Rust Belt. So what Pittsburgh had most of all that Clevelanders coveted, I think, and I won't go into the sports realm with this at all, because I really don't focus as much on sports. Right. Very little on sports in this book. And Pittsburgh was that they had a very, at least compared to Cleveland, a very unified leadership going back to the 1940s. And I don't think you could find quite the degree of cohesiveness in Cleveland's business community. I call it, you know, like others have called it, a growth coalition. I can explain more about that in a moment if you'd like. But certainly, the Allegheny Conference on Community Development that formed in the mid-40s in Pittsburgh was a really important organization for unifying development and redevelopment in that city. And so they had a few really outstanding examples of how they were turning Pittsburgh around. And there's an image component to that that's hard to miss. So I do think that Clevelanders and people in other cities often looked to certain success stories and they thought, well, we're not measuring up. And I found this in New Orleans, I should add. New Orleanians are very often very pessimistic over the years about the city and how the problems seemed theirs alone. So it's a very distorted view.
Yeah, it was. You mentioned then, because you talk about Pittsburgh in early on in the book, but then you show the another one, Detroit, which has become the, you know, it's almost like the ranking has become Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Detroit as far as success in renewal is concerned.
Well, I guess I shouldn't. I don't know that I would go
some
there,
people
really.
Some people.
They're looking at downtown when they say that, because I think anyone who looks around Detroit knows that the revival is extremely uneven. And overall, the city is still really suffering. I mean, large stretches of doing very poorly, while the suburbs are doing okay, and downtown is you know, developing so rapidly. It's just stunning to see how quickly downtown is redeveloping. Cleveland is sort of in the same position, although I think that we don't have the vast stretches of desolation, at least where you don't see any buildings anymore. Mm-hmm. Cleveland maybe is just not torn down as many of its buildings as in Detroit. So you don't see prairies in Cleveland as much.
Going back briefly to the jokes thing, one of the things I remember in the 60s was Ronan Martin's Laugh In. Cleveland, most of their they had just a regular amount of Cleveland jokes. It was just normal, but that's because their creator, George Slatter, I think that's the way he pronounced his name, he was from Cleveland. He had Cleveland experience, and so he was just putting them in there. And I know there were articles and stuff written about why everybody picks on Cleveland and their jokes. And this was obviously before, as you point out, a lot of the issues were before the infamous river fire in 1969. So it is interesting how that whole thing still lives today in many ways.
Yeah, you know, one of the mysteries for me is just exactly when and and through whose mouths that were the words "the mistake on the lake" first uttered in relation to Cleveland's problems mm-hmm. as a city. I find it in the early 1960s here and there, but it just suddenly appears, and it grows after, especially after the river fire in 69, you start to see that term much more widely used, but it much predates that. So I was never really able to, that's one regret I have, is that maybe with this book newly out that, you know, someone out there will tell some stories. And you know, we have this oral history project that's longstanding at Cleveland State. And I'd love to interview some people about this who might have their own insights on it.
And then, of course, we have Randy Newman to thank for his wonderful song about Cleveland, which actually I think most Clevelanders now have adopted, because even though he clearly talks about the fire and everything, and the fact that it was used as the theme, the main title theme for the film Major League and stuff, people, I think, have adopted that song. It's not as bad as some of the other things where people want to do their best to forget about the some of these other situations. And
right.
So let's go back, let's dig a little deeper. You mentioned the term growth coalition, and I know I told you that was one of the terms I wanted to talk about a little bit, because it is important to your concept of, you know, when you're trying to revive a city or do some things to help a city, coalition. So what are we talking about when we talk about growth coalitions?
Well, the growth coalition is a term that appears from time to time in urban history and urban studies scholarship. It really, in some ways, just means the combination of different groups within a city whose object is growth. So it's a coalition. At its foundation, it's really a group of people who agree on one thing, at least, and that is that they support policies that drive urban growth or metropolitan growth. So with that said, often they're depicted as entities that are very cohesive. Maybe you look at places like Pittsburgh and say, okay, well, I can recognize this in the Allegheny Conference on Community Development, but maybe this is an example that at least to some degree was fairly cohesive and quite effective. But I would argue that not all cities have this. I guess I should back up and say that the term really was derived from a slightly different term called growth machines, which appeared in a work by John Logan and Harvey Milach in 1987 called Urban Fortunes, in which they talked about the rise of growth machines. And basically, I would identify growth coalitions or growth machines, however you want to reference them, as you know, business interests that range from industry to commerce. They cover all parts of the metropolitan area. Some may be focused downtown. Others may be focused in outlying areas. The major media, you know, so daily newspapers. We had three at one point in Cleveland, as you probably know. Mm-hmm. Department stores.
Actually, if you go back far enough, yeah, you're right.
Right. Yeah, you had the Plain Dealer, the Cleveland News, and the Cleveland Press
right.
back in the 1960s, into the early 60s, at least you had all three of those mm-hmm. That were daily. But it also, the Growth Coalition really also included City Hall, you know, so it's really it's public and private.
Right.
And at its best, it's all these interests maybe working together with a common goal in mind. In Cleveland, I found that was not always the case, though. In fact, it usually wasn't the case in Cleveland. There's a lot of internal dissension that in some ways makes talking about growth coalitions obscure more than it reveals.
I think that was what your main point was right from the beginning when you used the term, was that, mm-hmm. of course, I think if you look at the two versions of the term, coalition and machine, coalition sort of says that people are working together. I mean, a machine has to work in one way for it to work properly, but still, I think it is a good point to make, as far, especially about Cleveland, as you've pointed out, as far as people not willing or able to work together. And in fact, that sort of leads to my next question. The book presents the seemingly constant attempts by city leaders, and we both public and private, to redefine and renew the image of the Cleveland area. What were the attempts to make this successful so complicated? You've talked a little bit about it, but we can go a little bit more in depth, particularly related to the fact of different groups having different reasons or different views as to how to do this.
Sure. One thing that was often cited, and I think there's a good bit of truth behind this, that a lot of plans were hatched behind closed doors. And I'm talking about, I suppose some of them are more recently too, but there were certain examples of plans that, that their inception really came in secretive meetings, and then they're gradually put out to the public, and then the Growth Coalition goes to the public and says, we want you to support this. And so that kind of close to the vest, secretive way of getting a project going is not one that's likely to engender a lot of positive feeling from the people who feel like they've been left out of the conversation. Now, I think there's a lot more willingness to bring the public into conversations today than there was, say, 50 or 60 years ago. Erie View, just to take one example, this was the largest downtown urban renewal plan in the nation. If it had all come to pass, it would have been really a first-in-class kind of development nationally. And that was certainly what leaders in Cleveland were yearning for. What happened, though, I found a story really that had not been told. Usually the story that's told is that Mayor Anthony Celebrezze rolls out this plan, and it's part of the broader urban renewal effort in Cleveland, and it's announced in 1960, and the voters go and they approve it. They approve the bond issue to get it started, and on it goes. And but I found actually that it was this is one that's hatched, secretively behind closed doors back in 1959. Before it's announced, it's being discussed internally, and by the time it's announced, even the Cleveland City Planning Commission was surprised, because only a year earlier, the Growth Coalition had sponsored a $100,000 general plan for downtown Cleveland, this master plan called Downtown Cleveland 1975. So here's what we want Cleveland to be like by the time we get to 1975. Well, Erie View then adopts some of the things that are in the 1959 plan, but other things it just throws out the door or out the window. And so all of a sudden, the Cleveland Planning Commission, which had, been the one to release the 1959 study, finds out that, oh, we're doing Erie View. Okay. And in fact, I found it remarkable that one of the planning commissioners, city planning commissioners, had been quoted in the before Erie View was formally announced. And in the article, he was quoted as saying, in effect, don't expect anything big in downtown over the next decade or so. It'll be just incremental progress. You won't see any big projects. Well, a week or so later, Erie View is announced, and it's the largest plan in the United States. So that clearly shows that there's not a lot of conversation across groups at the time, that these things happen. Sometimes they're planned by a very small number of people, and people who you would think would be part of the process, the Planning Commission, have never even heard of this. So I found that just stunning.
And this is something these days, especially younger people, probably wouldn't really understand this as much as we you know, as back in that period of time. And that was the power of newspapers. You mentioned at the time mm-hmm. three and then two newspapers. The newspapers, you know, and they were often at cross purposes. I mean, the Plainview yeah. and the press, I mean, the two papers after the news stopped publishing, I think at 63. So the two papers were constantly fighting with each other. And so more often than not, you ended up with competition between the two papers as far as supporting or not supporting any particular project.
That's right. I found certainly in some cases the papers both lined up behind certain projects, but others they took opposing sides. In the 1950s, there was a subway plan for downtown in which the Plain Dealer actually went back and forth in it, either supporting or condemning it. And so it depended on the particulars of the plan. And in another case, there was a plan for a Hilton Hotel in the Mall, which actually is, you know, it's about, oh, let's see, it's about before the current Hilton that's beside the mall got built. But the city was trying to woo Conrad Hilton to build a 1,000 room convention hotel. And they promised him land on the mall. So that did not go over so well. The Plain Dealer came out strongly against it because, you know, for one reason, it was on public land, and not just any public land, but, you know, this was Cleveland's Daniel Burnham designed City Beautiful Plan influenced centerpiece. And while it had never really been fully realized the way Burnham had intended, it was still seen as a place that was special and not a place that should be, encroached upon by a massive hotel. But there's also some suggestion in the sources that the Plain Dealer was miffed that that this project was leaked to the press first, and that the press came out in favor of it when it announced it. And then so the Plain Dealer was left with either having to go along or, you know, being really kind of miffed that it was leaked to the press before maybe it should have been, took a different view. So it's hard to disentangle these things, but and I don't try to say that one factor, reshaped what the outcome was, to the exclusion of others. But it is worth noting these different, at least opinions about what might have been behind that, just to be true to the historical record and say that these are the things that people were citing as possible reasons for this rift on this particular issue.
I know when the Cleveland Press stopped publishing, when they finally went out of business, there was a lot of, but on both sides, the press, the people from the Plain Dealer were all, you know, crowing about it. And the people from the press were all saying, you know, your city's a mess now because we're gone. And that's at the tail end of that period of time. Of course, the press was the afternoon paper at the time. But
yeah,
it's funny when you talk about ideas and what they want, people want to do, and the fact that people don't always check with, you know, they don't work together on it. I still remember when Mayor Perk decided the best idea in the world would be to build a bridge to Toronto, to Canada, over Lake Erie. And it was like, he was going around saying, this is a great idea. And it was like, most people looked at that and said, what? it didn't come through. By that point, we were all pretty cynical. You know, most people in the Cleveland area were cynical. So any kind of plan, especially one like that, which didn't seem like it had much planning behind it. It was just sort of something he said. And so suddenly it got all this newspaper coverage and news coverage. So,
of course, Toronto is not even on Lake Erie.
Well, yeah. And I think it was Canada. It wasn't Ontario, Toronto. But, it really yeah. wasn't Toronto. I said that wrong. It really was just Canada. But the concept was this is a way to get back and forth to Canada. Of course, these days, that would be a real troublesome thing to do. I don't know how Detroit deals with having to, you know, with going back and forth to Windsor. But anyway, you talk about the concepts of renewal and decline. You want to get away from them being linear. I mean, especially in Cleveland. What do you mean by not linear when you're talking about renewal and decline in a city? Particularly
too often, That's a good question. Too often, we have this very simplistic view of cities as going through a period of growth, and then they reach their peak, then they fall into a long decline if they're in, you know, maybe the Great Lakes region or the Northeast, and they're dependent on older. Example, they go through this period of deindustrialization, and then at some point, maybe they hit rock bottom, and then they start to revitalize. And now, I don't want to say that historians are so simplistic in how they have dealt with this issue, because certainly I'm not the first historian to suggest that there is this sort of really difficult, as one scholar calls it, the rough road to Renaissance on John Tiford, a book that, you know, was very influential on my own scholarship. So I'm certainly not the first, but too often, particularly in the public arena and in the, you know, in media, we see this effort to try to reduce cities to some simple path. And I think it goes along with wanting to or needing to have a narrative, needing to have a sense that you're on some sort of path. And we see the same thing expressed with sports teams. You know, after years of decline, not decline, but maybe years of, you know, championship drought, suddenly the city of Cleveland has this new moment, and it comes out of the wilderness. And you know, now we're also seeing it with Houston. It's a sort of a cathartic moment, to say the least, for Houstonians, especially after you know what happened with Hurricane Harvey and all the flooding recently. To have the Astros win and bring, I think it's the first time in 55 years that they had a championship. So there's a great story that goes along with that. When people interviewed me for various newspaper articles on the RNC in Cleveland in 2016, I was really disappointed how often they wanted to seize upon 1969, the Cuyahoga River, as the kind of the pivot point. They wanted to tell this very simplistic story about since 1969, you know, when Cleveland hit its low point, it grew then to what it is today. I mean, I'm glossing it maybe a little more than most of them did, but they all felt the need to comment on the river fire. So that image dies hard. Others point to 1978. And, you know, I think there you're talking more about kind of an article of faith, even among more scholarly accounts of Cleveland, that 1978, when you had the default under Mayor Kucinich, that was the low point, that we had finally hit rock bottom. And then we had a comeback under, you know, Mayor Voinovich and then Mayor White. But what I found in my work is really that there were multiple moments, through the 1960s, the 1970s, 1980s, and since, we've gone through multiple moments where we thought that we were turning the corner. And you can see it again and again. So it really pushes back against that simplistic idea that this is a linear process. It's really, I argue, a tension between decline and revitalization. A lot of it depends on perception. A lot of it also depends on geography. So one part of a city may be doing well while other parts are not doing well. That's just the story of uneven metropolitan development. And in some ways, in talking about decline, I really had to be careful about using that word decline too loosely. So I do try to define it and to say that some forms of decline can be measured. Others are more perceptual. They see as a decline, someone else may see as something else. So I try to use the words metropolitan change whenever I get an opportunity. Of course, you can't do that every single time. And if you're writing a book about what people perceived as decline, you want to use the word decline.
I think that is an issue in general when it comes to history. Most people who aren't who don't necessarily have as much vested in history as a topic as those people who use it as a profession, they always think of history as purely linear. And while it is, I mean, obviously things happen one right after the other, topics aren't linear necessarily. You know, it's not a matter that something changes and the next thing changes and it just automatically flows. And so when you study an area or a period, you can't just say, well, this is what happened going day by day and come up with history.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Historians will tell anyone who will listen that that perspective matters, and that any story that we tell about the past is an interpretation, and it leaves certain things out because nothing can be comprehensive. So we're all trying to make sense of the past, and we're doing so through careful study of primary sources and, you know, and trying to make sense of things. I had to make a lot of decisions in the book about what to include and what not to include. And you know, every one of those decisions was an interpretive choice. And a lot of those interpretive choices are driven by the fact that, you know, I did enough research in several years' time to have produced a book easily twice or three times as long. But I couldn't really expect people to buy or read such a book. And really, sometimes you don't need all of the evidence that you found to make a point. So I tried to pick exemplary topics in each that, you know, digestible.
Right. So you broke the book down into basically two periods, but then you've got the middle, well, you know, obviously three periods, but the middle part is your centerpiece, and that's the mayoralty period of Karl Stokes. Why did you consider that to be a logical period to use as your centerpiece?
Well, for a variety of reasons. You know, the book is titled Believing in Cleveland, and somewhere along the way I picked up that title as kind of it became sort of how I was conceptualizing my project. I should say briefly that the name Believe It, or the title Believing in Cleveland, was inspired by the Plain Dealers ad campaign in 2005, which was called simply Believe in Cleveland. And the suggestion there was that we needed to believe in the city because that was part of what it might take to make Cleveland continue to prosper or to begin to prosper. And it also suggested that maybe the comeback of the 80s and 90s had run out of steam. And I think that on some level it did. We did see a slowdown in development. We saw about 100,000, I think, manufacturing jobs leaving Cuyahoga County in a 10-year period in the 2000s. And so clearly, not everything was going so well. And so I saw that as an effort to kind of rally Clevelanders. But as I started looking backward then, I started finding other uses of that concept of believing in the city. And I was really taken when I saw a 1967 Karl Stokes for Mayor ad in which he said, I believe in Cleveland. And so he believed in the city again. And while he's really talking in that ad about very substantive problems, which Cleveland and other cities certainly had in the late 1960s, this is, I think, a pivotal moment. But he was also very much aware that Cleveland had developed an image problem and a sort of a self-image problem. So, you know, he comes into office just a year after the Huff Uprising, which is, you know, a series of what happened, types of events that happened in a lot of cities where, you know, racial clashes occurred for a variety of reasons, ranging from, you know, concerns of the police brutality to failed urban renewal, to lack of code enforcement in neighborhoods that was sort of hastening their decay, really a host of you know, human problems connected to urban places. And so Cleveland was not immune to these problems by any stretch. And we had the Huff incident in 66. And when Karl Stokes takes office, I really see it as this pivotal moment because very clearly at that time, Cleveland is in the throes of what the historian Tom Segrew calls the urban crisis, and that's a term that's widely circulated now. It was very clear that Cleveland had been in an urban crisis for quite a while, and that crisis had come to a head by 1966 and 67. So I do see that as kind of this pivotal moment in which to study this historic mayoralty, the first African-American elected to be mayor of a major American city, and to look at a tighter period and put the different themes together that were spread out across three chapters in the 60s, pull those together, and let's look at them for a four-year period when he was mayor. So that's really why I made that central. I think it's a time of central importance, and I think it's a time that maybe things could have turned out differently, but for a few things that happened in the late 60s.
Yeah, there's no question that because like many major American cities, Cleveland has, especially during this period, was having a major issues related to race, and Carl Stokes' election was considered to be, an unbelievably great thing by some people, and then of course by other people that lived in the area, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But what Carl Stokes really did was that he reframed what people thought about Cleveland for a short time, at least. Right. There was this moment of hope where Cleveland was in a positive national spotlight, at least for a year or so there in 67, 68. I argue that he used the Cleveland Now slogan very adeptly to try to, at least at first, to try to package a combination of projects that ranged from things that were very attainable, they were small, very visible projects, to things that were almost insoluble problems, things that it might take 25 years to remedy because of the sheer complexity of problems, the amount of money that it would take to really solve those problems, and so on. So he really, I think, adeptly used small, incremental, highly visible projects that would give the image of progress to a city that had seen, in many ways, not a lot of progress in the preceding years. It had seen an urban renewal of any American city. And I don't just mean Erieview now. I mean the entire city had more than 6,000 acres of land under federal urban renewal status, but precious few of those acres ever got redeveloped, at least in the time frame that people were anticipating. And so when Stokes took office, he said, one of our priorities is to get affordable housing in this city. And we've done more destroying of affordable housing for people than we've done to create it. And but you don't do that overnight. And so he did a number of other things to try to show the intent to turn things around. And so I explore those things in that chapter.
It's funny that we went through this same in 1975 when Cleveland had the first African American manager of a Major League Baseball team, and once again everything was great about Cleveland. And then within 2 years, one of the radio broadcasters for the Indians was openly criticizing the manager on the air all the time. It was just another example of one thing going positive and then starting to sort of fall away as time went on, but it's got its similarities there.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the cutoff point for the study? How late did you go? Because obviously, as you pointed out, you could have gone much farther and make the book three times its size. But what did you decide? Where did you decide to stop to cut off your study?
Well, I started it in World War II,
right?
It begins really. It begins in the time that the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company created the slogan, "The Best Location in the Nation." And so since that's in my interested in sort of what happens after the relative boom time of the war years, I started there and I ended it in 1979, approximately, right after the default and right at the time that Mayor Voinovich took office, because that was the time that people termed the comeback, or the comeback years, mm-hmm. when Cleveland was, sometimes touted as America's comeback city. So I wanted to take this idea that some scholars have put forth of Messiah mayors, people like Voinovich, who come in and rescue a city from, from the clutches of decline, and reframe the narrative. Certainly, Voinovich is one of the mayors that fits that. Model. Others are, William Donald Schaefer in Baltimore, Kevin White in Boston, among others. So I wanted to push back a little against that, not to say that Messiah mayors didn't exist and that they were insignificant, because I don't think that I certainly wouldn't want to diminish the significance of the positive things that were accomplished. But on the other hand, to suggest that the narrative is so simplistic that really all it took was the right mayor to come into office, and then things were suddenly going to go in a very different direction and keep going that way, I think is misleading. And so I wanted to cut it off there, since so much attention focused on the 1980s and 90s as a time of renewed prosperity. Mm-hmm. And I thought by ending with the comeback, I could help people better understand sort of what led up to that and why was it seen as a comeback. Then to sort of complicate understandings of what it meant to come back. And I found out, hey, we've been coming back again and again. We're in this perpetual state of trying to come back, and I think we're there again now. Right. I'm not sure that we're going to, come back the way everyone maybe wishes we would. There's certainly some positive signs, but I do have a healthy measure of reservation about, getting out my penance and my, my bullhorn and cowbell. I'm not quite ready to ring the cowbell and shout. I'm happy to see the positive things that are happening in our city, but I also see a lot of problems. So,
well, I know we're running out of time. I wanted to real quickly talk about resources. I know that my experience and obviously one of the things that Cleveland has, and I don't know what your experiences is with other cities, but the Cleveland area definitely has some really great primary sources. Archives that I suspect were very helpful for you for this project, and the fact that they were mm-hmm. local made it a little easier as far as doing some of the research you had to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It really helped quite a lot to have wonderful repositories like Western Reserve Historical Society. I found so many amazingly detailed records and manuscript papers in that library, ranging from mayor's papers to other city officials' records to the entities such as the Greater Cleveland Growth Association, University Circle Incorporated, and so on. The fact that the Plain Dealer is now fully indexed and keyword searchable through the Cleveland Public Library.
I'm really thankful that
that's, yeah.
I worked there for 30 years. So Cleveland Public Library is always one of those places that I always point to as a positive for Cleveland.
Absolutely. And this collection that they have, of course, it's a subscription service that they pay for. But thank goodness they do, because I can tell you that for my New Orleans book, I read 30 years worth of microfilm for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. I literally cranked the microfilm slowly, frame by frame for a 30-year period before I started. At that point, I just couldn't do anymore. That covered a lot of the ground I needed to cover, and I found countless sources doing that. It helped me piece together the basic narrative. So that's really important, but having the ability to dive in through very powerful keyword searches really just transforms research. You don't feel now like you have to sort of follow the newspaper all the way through for fear of missing key developments or missing the trajectory as it's presented, at least from one perspective. So I really felt like I needed that when I did the New Orleans book, but I felt much more comfortable diving in and doing targeted searches in the Plain Dealer, and then of course going to all my other types of sources than I would have without that. So definitely tremendous. CSU Special Collections also had a lot of great resources for me. The County Archives, Cuyahoga County Archives, was very helpful. And CPL's Cleveland Public Library's Public Administration Library guided me to a lot of rich materials, including the source of the book's cover. So that was discovered right there in City Hall.
Right. It's interesting. The Cleveland Public Library actually has a branch at City Hall whose main, one of their purposes is to be the library for the city administration. And you're right, the amount of material that they've been able to acquire and keep over the years, it's been pretty tremendous. So what's next for you? I know you detail some future plans on your website, marksouther.org, but what's your current research taking you?
Well, I'm exploring different topics. One that's not listed on there that I want to do more with is, and this is not a book project, but it's more something that I think I would write an article on. I want to look more at the Cleveland Clinic area and around Euclid and 105th. That's a really fascinating area that I partially explored in both the book and in a 2011 Journal of Planning History article about University Circle institutions and their relationship with surrounding neighborhoods. But I'm really interested in looking more directly at what was considered Cleveland's second downtown, and also to look at largely its erasure as the Cleveland Clinic developed. So that's something I want to do more with. I've also been looking at this project in Georgia, my home state, looking at the fall line cities of Augusta, Macon, and Columbus. And I'm finding some interesting patterns in looking at those three cities. And so I'm really interested to see how these three places that emerge, really a lot of it had to do with, being on the heads of navigable in the 19th century and the rise of the textile industry. All these were, to varying degrees, textile centers. And in fact, two of them claimed to be the Lowell of the South. So, and as you move forward into the 20th century, all three of these struggle with the same kinds of urban problems that bigger cities face. And, the loss of people and jobs to the suburbs, growing suburbs, and also marginalization as Atlanta became the sort of the New South capital. These places that are down in the middle of the state languished by comparison. And also, all three of them end up in the later years of the 20th century pursuing and eventually succeeding in consolidating city and county government, which is something that, if you look at Cleveland, for example, you find that there were plans over the years to try to create some sort of unified government, and every single time it failed miserably. Of course, it's because we're ringed by 60 municipalities in Cuyahoga County.
Right.
They didn't have those problems in these Georgia communities. And then for Augusta specifically, it, of all the three of those, became a rather strong tourist destination in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, well before the Augusta National Golf Club started hosting the Masters. Augusta was touting itself as the winter resort capital of America, which was a bit of a stretch, of course, but it did enjoy quite a lot of success in that. And so I'm interested in exploring how you know, the rivalries among those three very similar cities played out across, you know, about. So a lot will depend for that. A lot will depend on what kind of primary sources I'm able to find down there. And I haven't really, for that one, I've been exploring the newspapers online, which thankfully are available for those three cities. But I need to figure out sort of what the primary sources, you know, in Georgia will support. So those are a couple of projects that are on the horizon. And, you know, I'll also keep doing the public and digital history projects. I'm currently doing an NEH-funded digital project with a university over in Kenya. So continuing to work on those things too.
Well, thanks for talking to me, Mark. This was a real treat for me. As I say, I've been following your announcements of the book, following your posts where you start to talk about each step. I even remember the one where you said, how do I find an indexer? and things like that. So it's been fun following the project of the book, you know, the progress. And I'm glad we were able to talk, and good luck with the book. And I hope it continues to do well.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the time this morning, and I'm very thankful for the opportunity.
Thanks to Mark for his time. This is Joel Cherney for the New Books Network.